Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams, in for Ann. In 2021, the ban preventing incarcerated individuals from getting Pell Grants for higher education was lifted. Nearly 500,000 people in prison stand to benefit from this rollback. This hour, we're addressing how these programs are being reconstructed and the role education plays in prisoners' lives. Taylor Swack reports for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Her work focuses on technology and equitable education. Taylor, welcome.
Thanks so much, Natasha. Happy to be here.
Well, prison education programs are being reconstructed to account for an increased demand from prisoners who want to take advantage of them. How many of these programs will be brand new?
That's a great question. And honestly, so even though Congress a year or two ago announced that Pell was going to be reinstated, the full reinstatement doesn't happen until next July, July 2023. So we're still at that kind of early stage process where colleges that are interested are starting to game plan, getting in touch with their accrediting agencies and taking the initial steps. So just how many programs, it might be a little too early to tell, but colleges are definitely on their way.
But there were obviously a number of programs that had these systems in place before the shutdown happened. So do you have a relative number on how many there were?
I unfortunately don't have that exact number, but I do know obviously that in the last 30 years, it has substantially decreased from what it was before, being that, you know, these federal Pell Grants provided colleges essentially with the funding that they needed to operate these programs. And, you know, the one or two that I did talk to for a story I wrote recently, I talked with a faculty member that was essentially doing it on a volunteer basis. And in some cases with colleges, you know, if they have the funding to fit it in their budget, they have. But it's been quite a low number pre-1990s that's hopefully going to start rising pretty soon.
Are there concerns on the part of prison education advocates about the quality of these educational programs? Because you hear good stories and you hear bad stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've read before that there's been a history of exploitation from for-profit companies for prisoners. And so, you know, certainly something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on as a reporter is, you know, what for-profit third-party vendors maybe will come out of the woodwork and are trying to capitalize on this expansion. That's definitely something we want to watch. You know, and I've talked with some colleges as well, where the issue they have right now is they don't necessarily have the resources to create an in-house system that meets all the security parameters, but they're also not super satisfied with the options that exist currently. You know, not to call anyone out, but I've spoken to a few colleges that right now partner with, you know, Securus, JPay, that say just the connection is not great with downloading and uploading assignments. And so I think there's definitely a question of, if we do scale up, how do we do so in an equitable way that provides students with the quality of education that they deserve?
Make some actual improvements, you know, because I mean, without proper internet, it's kind of hard to interact. And that's a lot of what some of the students were talking about in articles I read. The criticism about a lot of it was that, you know, it's not really personal. They need to feel like they have like a personal touch. It's very impersonal. Can you tell us like where these criticisms come from as far as like the fact that it's just not very personal? It's more impersonal.
So I've actually, and this is an interesting question, because colleges that I've spoken with that are going to be scaling up seemed pretty set on, even if they do try to use technology more, that they still want to keep that in-person component, because they do say it's really critical. I was talking with one college, the University of Central Florida, that has run a prison program, including during the pandemic, and when things had to go completely asynchronous. I think my source was telling me that the course completion rate dropped from 100% in fall of 2019, when there was some of that in-person support, to 68% in fall of 2020. And, you know, from what I've heard, one, digital literacy is obviously a huge barrier. So if you're switching to online and you haven't taught students in prison how to use those tools, there's a lot of issues with troubleshooting or just being able to navigate the technology. And Also, you know, they said as well, and I received written responses from some prisoners. They do really value that face-to-face interaction, that personalized attention. You know, experts have told me as well that something that we sometimes forget is that, you know, students in prison, especially if this is maybe their first time in higher education, they might not have honed the proper studying, time management skills, certain skills that we take for granted, where, you know, having that in-person help and personalized support is really critical to their success in moving forward and just feeling like someone has their back. And so that's why, from what I've heard, because of those reasons, I've heard from colleges that what the goal is, you know, how can we use technology in a smart way to scale up, introduce students to more resources, but still maintain that in-person, you know, there's someone there with you in a classroom for that personalized attention.
So when you talk about the prisoners pursuing the education with little to no face-to-face instruction, you talk about those numbers just really going down. I mean, to me, that appears that would make the program just not successful. I mean, if the students are dropping out or they're not getting what they need out of it, and they maybe have to repeat some things because they don't pass, that's kind of a definite downer.
Right. And yeah, I get the sense that, again, in the next year, this is something that a lot of colleges are going to have to think about how do we balance the two? Because on the one hand, when you incorporate digital tools, technology, you can really expand the students that you can reach. Especially, we know, I think some 70% of prisons are in more rural locations. So if you can incorporate like a technology, like a Zoom, their students, or maybe it has been an option, or you just realistically can't get people boots on the ground there, where that is now an opportunity. But yeah, on the other side of the coin, then it's like, okay, but we need to make sure that if we do that, can we still have a quality program? You know, are we confident in our abilities? Do we have the resources to make it synchronous, for example, to still have that professor-student interaction outside the classroom? Like, what's feasible? So I think that's going to be something that colleges are really grappling with, maybe wanting to expand, but wanting to make sure that what they are offering is still a quality program for all of their students, irregardless of the modality.
But so many of the rural areas still struggle greatly, as we found out during the pandemic, with having internet services. So it's with a situation like that, where you can't even get internet for children that are in school, staying at home, you know, with their parents, it just seems like that's an uphill battle.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. And there are some, you know, the vast majority of these programs, they're not using Wi-Fi internet just because of the security parameters. So I know some have like locally hosted servers where you can basically upload a ton of offline content, whether that's research, whether that's assignments, and then any devices inside the prison, kind of inside that firewall, have access to that. And so that's a way to kind of get around, I think, maybe some of those internet Wi-Fi barriers. But still, I think the more that people are learning what's possible with tech, you know, they want to expand. I was at a conference recently and someone was like, how can we finagle a way to start getting Wi-Fi to prisons? Because students need to be able to conduct research. They're really going to have higher education degrees, et cetera. Like, we need to find a way to safely, but you're right, there are a lot of barriers. So I think there's some maybe immediate ways to get at that, like I mentioned, but I think it's gonna be a years long. How can we build up and address some of these issues?
So let's talk about the similarities that exist between the methods of instruction on college campuses, you know, compared to those in a prison environment. You know, what are the similarities? I mean, obviously face-to-face if you have interaction and things like that. But I mean, there have to be differences because there is a prison situation.
I mean, the sense that I get is comparatively it is limited because students aren't able to access websites to properly research. You know, I know some colleges that have partnered with third-party vendors, students are working on tablets that are 7 inches, mm-hmm. which I think is maybe the size of my iPhone.
Pretty much, yeah.
So I'm kind of imagining doing all my work on my phone, and I'm like, after an hour, I would probably want to just throw it out a window. You know, these devices as well that a lot of students are using, you have to plug them into a kiosk. Sometimes the content that's supposed to be there isn't there, or you can't download. So I think there's a lot of, even just what maybe we take for granted, just simple things as part of a class, submitting and downloading assignments just becomes more difficult. And so, you know, the sense that I get for many programs, or at least during the pandemic, is that some did utilize Zoom that could. There would be an education staff member at the prison that would have a Zoom account and have access. And students who are in prison would essentially come into a room and see the professor on the Zoom screen, have a synchronous lesson, and then have these tablets to have access to downloaded content to do assignments. But I think it's just restricted. Like I said, when you don't have access to research, to live sites, I think it just restricts what you're able to do. And because of that, I know a few colleges that I spoke with, and I think this is something that's maybe going to change moving forward with Pell Grant reinstatement. They're not all for college credit. Some of these are kind of seen more as certificates and getting that interest in learning going, with the hope that that then encourages them and gives them a stepping stone to, you know, hopefully once they are released from prison, to continue their education. But I think because of a lot of these restrictions and maybe it not being able to reach the standard for course credit, that's, you know, students aren't necessarily getting that when they participate in these programs.
So we talked about some of the downsides. So what are some examples of prison education programs that actually have successful track records? I mean, there has to be a couple good programs out there, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I'll be candid, I don't have data on hand, but there were two in particular that I highlighted in a story I wrote recently where I was just really intrigued with their work. One of them, Washington University in St. Louis, WashU, you know, they actually harnessed the talent of people who were previously in prison to build a new platform. It's called Unlocked. And they actually just rolled it out a few weeks ago at a women's prison. And I think what was so unique about this program is that it was created by people who know that environment so well and have been in the shoes of these students. And so, you know, the woman I was talking to just made really good points, just even in just the design. She's like, we designed this platform that exists on a local server so that it kind of looks like a site you might have looked at 10 years ago. Because again, some of these students have not been online or used a computer. And she's like, sometimes like a 2022 website or design, like it's actually very overwhelming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she's like, so we really simplified the design. They incorporated almost like kudos or positive reinforcement into assignments. Like you can get coins or even just positive reinforcement, again, kind of acknowledging that a lot of these students have not built up those positive studying habits and actually do need that reinforcement. She was saying sometimes we forget, we just assume adults, they can push through, they have the studying work ethic. And she's like, it's really important to tailor it to the population that you're serving. And so I actually, that reminds me, I really want to circle back with them and see how it's going, because I think they just started incorporating that a few weeks ago. But I thought that that was a really good approach. And again, just thinking of partnerships and ways to kind of think outside the box, I thought that was a really interesting approach. And then another one, University of Madison, Wisconsin, I think provided a good example of how you don't need to reinvent the wheel to incorporate a program. They found a peer school about an hour away that had basically created an open source version of Canvas that operates within the prison security parameters that they have to. And so essentially they pay this college to have access to the content on their server, and students just log in through the secure portal and access it that way. And so they're able to better serve their students without having to create their own system from scratch, but they're partnering with another college that's doing similar work. And so I thought that was a smart way, and a reminder as well that colleges that are kind of starting on this path and doing this work, you're not necessarily alone and that there are some other innovative things happening and maybe there is the potential for partnership there.
Let's talk about some other major challenges that stand in the way, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I was at a conference the other week with a bunch of colleges that either currently have programs or are starting to scale them up in the next year, again, in preparation for this reinstatement. And so many of them, I think, just want guidance and best practices, because the prison space is just so unique. Flow of information within prisons is so tightly constrained, and flow of information, like, that's higher ed. It's the exchanging of ideas and information. And so, you know, there are a lot of topics that were coming up, just some colleges, again, and I think you were kind of maybe getting at this a little bit before, that we're just saying, you know, we don't have computer labs, and we don't necessarily, like, the infrastructure for us isn't even if we wanted to bring in Wi-Fi on a restricted basis, for example, for research, we don't have the capacity. So that's like an additional step before we even start off. How do we get there to just have the capacity to offer it? I think I've heard the most that colleges were concerned about or frustrated about is that so much of the constraints on a prison are not only like state level, but also very individualized. Just in the individual who's running the prison or the wardens really do dictate what students might have access to and the extent of the security parameters. And I had colleges or Department of Corrections officials telling me that many people in these positions are still of that traditional decades ago mindset of, you know, safety and security above all else. You know, the second we incorporate any technology, we're going to open the doors to people in prison exploiting it, you know, finding a way to reach out and harass or taunt victims. And not to say that that's unfounded, but there's, I think, a lot of hesitancy to innovate and do some of this creative thinking and scaling up that colleges want to do. And there has to be buy-in. And I think in a lot of cases that buy-in is coming kind of slowly. And so I think that's hindering some progress as well for these programs.
So are the educational providers optimistic, though, about the expansion of prison education programs? Are they optimistic? I mean, do they think, despite these challenges, despite the wardens who are kind of old school, that they're actually going to work?
I think they're hopeful. I don't know if I've had enough conversations to make a general they're optimistic. I could just tell from the conference as that people are passionate. You know, they have these barriers, but they're not necessarily saying, okay, well, we tried and that's it. You know, they are asking each other, what did you do? Do you have any advice? How could we do this better? So I think despite the challenges, there seems to be a real resolve to find ways to work around them and lean on each other. So I think the passion to expand these programs and do it in a quality way really seems to be there at the college level. And I think it will just be a matter, you know, part of the Chronicle's work in the next year as we approach this reinstatement is going to kind of be following this process and getting a sense of how that goes.
Are there incentives out there to encourage institutions to provide education in prisons?
That's a good question. You know, these students, I could see, for example, that for some colleges, and we know that during the pandemic, especially, but even in the past decade, that enrollment is declining. So, I mean, if we are thinking a little bit selfishly from a college standpoint, there is a potential door here for new students, a way to increase enrollment. But I think what I've heard too from some is there almost feels like a moral responsibility as well. You know, we just have there is data that just shows how effective education is for reducing recidivism. And when you give students the tools that they leave and actually can and have the chance to become contributing members to society versus coming back into prison. So again, I've talked with some colleges that are just saying, we kind of feel as a higher ed institution whose mission is to educate others, like a moral responsibility here to help be part of the solution. And so I think that's a driving force as well, beyond just the, hey, here's some potential new students to increase our enrollment.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for talking with us. We're talking with Taylor Sweck for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She focuses on technology and equitable education. We really appreciate the conversation and the worthwhile information. It'll be interesting to see how it pans out as we get back closer to actually implementing these programs.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Natasha.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams, in for Ann. In 2021, legislation restricting incarcerated individuals' access to federal funds was lifted. As a result, nearly 500,000 people will now have access to Pell Grants. Education programs are being rebuilt in prison environments. Not only will they provide prisoners with college degrees, they'll increase community engagement. Mary Thomas is the co-director of the Ohio Prison Education Exchange Project, known as OPEEP. The goal of the program is to expand high-quality education access for justice-involved individuals. Mary, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Donald Washington works with the Marshall Project, a news organization covering stories about and from criminal justice settings. Donald earned his college diploma from Mercy College while at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. Donald, welcome to you.
Hey, Natasha, thank you for having me.
So, Mary, let's start with you. Can you tell us about the program that you direct?
Certainly. I'm a co-director with Dr. T.E. Morris of African American African Studies at the Newark campus. OPEEP is a project that is building here at OSU to provide more classes in prison facilities that bring campus students to learn side by side with incarcerated students. And so we're this semester offering classes at three Central Ohio prisons: at the Ohio Reformatory for Women, Richland Correctional in Mansfield, and Southeastern Correctional Institution in Lancaster. Everyone enrolled in those classes receives credits, although at this point in time, we don't have any degree options available, although we hope to be able to expand in the future.
So how common is it for education programs in prisons to have in-person offerings?
It's pretty uncommon to have campus students learning in person with incarcerated students. There are scattered course availability across the country through the Inside Out model of teaching, but something of this scale is really uncommon, especially throughout a whole region like ours. And we also have five campuses of OSU involved in offering these classes now. So those in-person classes really make a big difference, because campus students learn something about the world they wouldn't otherwise, and incarcerated students learn about their intellectual heft and what they can contribute to campus students' learning. And the intergenerational learning when you're in person like that is just really phenomenal.
So, Donald, can you tell us about your experience at Mercy College, how they conducted their program at Sing Sing? You obviously have a very unique perspective, been there and having to go through it.
Having gone through it then, I began that program in 2010, and it was very different than how things are conducted now. So at that time, you had to have already had college credits to enter the program. Mm. I was able to enter through a program called Hudson Link, and it was a life-changing experience on so many levels and in so many different ways. So I arrived at Sing Sing Correctional Facility in 2008, and I learned about the program, and it was kind of like surreal. So when individuals told me about the program and the things that were happening there, I couldn't believe it at first. Again, during that time, you had to have already had college credits. I was coming in with an eighth grade education. I had no higher education experience at all. So what I did was save money for my mess hall job, right? I was working, making about 20 cents per hour, and I was saving money and studying sociology because I wanted to take a correspondence course to at least gain college credits to become eligible to enter the program. So there was like this huge demand from the men who were at the facility to get into the program. And it was just, it was an amazing experience.
But you had to find a way to do it. You had to use your money and kind of get creative in the process, right?
So you had to be creative at that time because you had to have already had college credits. Now in that particular facility, Sing Sing, they have what's called a pre-college course where they really kind of prep guys to go in, whether or not they have college credits, just to allow them to be eligible. Again, this is before Pell had been reinstated. I had to be creative because I had this thirst for it, right? So I found myself going to the college office daily and kind of like nagging the guys who were in there about really getting in the program. And they would just tell me like, just be ready for the placement exam, right? So it took me about a year because it's cyclical, right? So it took me about a year to actually get into the program from 2009 when I had completed my correspondence course in sociology to 2010 to actually get in the program. And when I got in, it was just, it was everything that I imagined it would be and more, right? So I think the most important thing about it is it was a choice, right? So this wasn't a mandated program. This wasn't something that was required by my sentence. It was something that I wanted to do myself. It was something that I had an envision for myself, like during the early years of my incarceration. But once I got in, it was really like a college environment. And I think that the college program itself really changed the culture of that particular facility, right? So I had been to a number of maximum security facilities by the time I arrived at Sing Sing in 2018, and they were very different, right? The amount of violence of the facilities was far beyond what you saw at a facility like Sing Sing. And I think that most of that grew not only from other volunteer programs, but primarily from this college program where the men who were at the facility were in college in some instances, right? So I became a college student. It wasn't just about me just being a prisoner in a facility doing time. No, I was focused on my education. I was thinking about this thing. I was engaged in these studies. I was engaged in these courses. And we didn't have tablets, which they do in some facilities now. We had textbooks. Some of them were a bit older. And I would read cover to cover. So that was like my big thing. Like I would read cover to cover. So I really found myself immersing myself and engaging myself in each course that I took. And with that, there was a certain level of productivity that I had with my time that I wouldn't have.
It gave you a reason to get up in the morning.
It gave you a reason to be excited, right? So we all have to wake up in the morning if we're blessed to do so. But do you wake up with a level of excitement, mm-hmm. or do you wake up with dread? Like mm-hmm. I wake from a dream and I'm in prison. No, I'm getting up early. I know I need to go to the library to get this extra book because I'm writing this research paper, right? So it gives you a purpose and a drive that otherwise isn't there.
Awesome. That sounds like it was an incredible experience for you. Mary, OPEEP is not associated with the Second Chance Pell program. Does that limit your abilities to engage with incarcerated populations?
Not at this point, it doesn't, because what we're doing now is just expanding coursework. If we want to have a degree option in place at a facility, then we will probably have to get involved with the Pell Grant program, yes.
So education has been shown to reduce recidivism rates. Do you think that the personal interactions that come along with the education influence, that likelihood will not be to reoffend?
You know, I have to say that research, when you take a deep dive into it, actually really what makes a big difference are four-year degree programs. And so when students are able to finish their GEDs in high school, that doesn't have a very strong influence in recidivism. Associate's degrees have some, but four-year degrees actually wipe out any chance of recidivism. And so what we're trying to do in Ohio, and we're unique in this, is to offer a four-year liberal arts degree embedded in Ohio prisons. Probably we can only have the capacity to do one or two facilities over time. Mm-hmm. But really, I think that's important to note because a liberal arts college education is a really different kind of thing than vocational training. It offers a different perspective on the world. It makes people understand their own citizenship, their own practices in the world through critical means. So I do think it's important for us to really understand that data.
So it says degree can mean more job opportunities, obviously, for a person. Tell us about the education, how it could affect the remainder of their sentence.
Well, certainly the research also shows that prisons that have educational opportunities in place have lower rates of violence and lower rates of just conflict at the facility. And I think that Donald attests to why that's the case.
So, Donald, what does could you tell me what does the range of engagement prison programs environments look like? What is it? What is that range?
Say from facility to facility.
Yes, the range, like basically the range of engagement programs in prison environments, do they look like you said at your particular one, it was an older time, but now you mentioned the fact that there are so many more opportunities. They have tablets, they have computers, things like that.
Yeah, now there are more facilities that offer college programs. Again, you have tablets, so you have access to more information, more books, right? So now I'm not waiting on this textbook. You know, I'm not the second person online for it. I think that just presents a greater opportunity for individuals to consume just different information. Also, you have a younger prisoner who are coming in with a certain level of technology that you didn't in the past. So when I began the college program, the technology that I had come from was far different than what it is now, right? So there were no tablets, cell phones weren't used to the degree that they are now. So a textbook would be a pretty, you know, reasonable thing to expect. Now, a person who's coming into a facility now who may be 2 or 3 years into their sentence, they're not really used to reading in print. They're used to reading it in a digital form. That particular facility did coursework in the facility, right? So it wasn't online or anything like that. You were actually in a classroom. You had a computer lab where sometimes a professor or an associate of the program might come in and engage us on a few things.
Okay. Can I answer that question too? I think it's really important for us to remember that incarcerated people are a huge spectrum of difference, right? And so a lot of people who are incarcerated really want to get a vocational degree, or they want to get a certification so that when they get out, they can go ahead right into a job and take care of their families. Many of our incarcerated Ohioans are parents, and they need to think about how are they going to get housing? How are they going to reintegrate? And really getting a job as soon as they get out is the number one priority. And those kind of certification programs are phenomenal in helping people, especially in today's economy, be able to get employment really quickly. There are also a large range of associate's degrees that places like Sinclair Community College offers here in Ohio. And so people can get degrees in business administration and hospitality and restaurant management and cooking, which also allows people to go into employment pretty quickly. But I think it's also just really important to remember that incarcerated people, there are a lot who also want to get that 4-year degree, who want to spend time doing intellectual exploration and academic growth, just like there are youth today who want 4-year college degrees, and there are youth today who like to go into community college and get a 2-year degree as electricians. And so remembering that kind of breadth and being able to allow for that, I think, is really important, because it also helps us to remember that incarcerated people are a diverse, huge group of vibrant people.
All right, what are some of the valuable takeaways that you and your colleagues, students in OPEEP have from these programs?
Sure. Well, I think that there are three communities who really are impacted. First are the professors, second are the campus students, and third are the incarcerated students. And so all three of those groups have a really profound impact on their teaching and learning practices, but also in their sense of social justice and education and the potentials for building communities off campus or outside of the prison itself. And so the impacts, I think, are life-changing and permanent. It's really hard for me after teaching in a prison to remember what it's like to not have learned what I learned teaching in a prison. And the same is true for campus students. Once they're able to get off campus to take a class and to learn in the community, they really can't go back to campus and not share what they've learned with other students and other classes. And then incarcerated students are able to be in the world, even though they're confined within razor wire. They're able to understand themselves beyond that space of dehumanization, and they're able to really engage and watch the news and think about engagement in different ways. And they also, a lot of the women I teach at the Ohio Reformatory for Women, share what they're learning with their children. And so to them, it's a very empowering and joyful experience to be able to talk to their kids about what they're learning in college.
So Ashland University is a major provider of education to prisons, but has received a lot of backlash because of their text-based interpersonal structure of their courses. What do you have to say about those critics? Is something better than nothing?
I think that that is likely true. I think that though with Second Chance Pell and with the expansion of capacity, we're going to see an explosion of different ideas and approaches to prison pedagogies. And I hope that we're at the point where we can continue to expand knowledge, to collect data on what works, and also to dream about what's possible, especially here in Ohio, for our incarcerated people. So I do think that there are limits to how things have been done in the past, but that's because there's a huge range of reasons why there have been those limits. Now's the opportunity for us to really reimagine what prison education can be.
Well, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking to Mary Thomas, co-director of the Ohio Prison Education Exchange Program, OPEEP, and Donald Washington Jr., who was a part of a prison program and successfully got his degree from Mercy College. Thank you both for joining us on All Sides. And we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams, in for Ann. Bans preventing incarcerated individuals from getting federal funds for higher education were lifted in 2021. St. Clair Community College in Dayton was one of 22 institutions selected for the Second Chance Pell Grant program. That additional funding is helping these schools to restructure for new students. Still with us is Donald Washington Jr., producer and executive director, executive assistant for the Marshall Project. Donald completed his college degree with Mercy College while at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. Joining us is Cheryl Taylor. Cheryl serves as the Chief Officer of Prison Education and Returning Citizen Initiative at St. Clair Community College. Cheryl, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Cheryl, could you tell us about the Second Chance Pell Institution? What is it?
This just provides opportunities for students to continue their education utilizing Pell dollars. Up to this point in the state of Ohio, we have been utilizing state dollars. And, you know, that has limited the number of students that we've been able to serve thus far.
Sure. What are the first steps? What have they been for St. Clair to restructure for new students after becoming a Second Chance Pell institution?
Basically kind of looking at financial aid, restructuring what that looks like, looking at our programs, making sure they're Title IV compliant, looking at the process, seeing who's eligible. This is really going to open up doors for students to continue their education and complete it prior to release and not be restricted by a limited number of classes and hours per term.
So does this status offer additional benefits to St. Clair?
It just gives us more opportunity to serve the students. It also allows us to look at different programs, you know, beyond what we've been offering. We're hoping to get into more STEM areas and just really prepare them better for when they walk out the door.
And speaking of walking out the door, Donald, talk about how educational influences, how it influenced the remainder of your prison sentence. How did it affect your time after leaving Sing Sing? Obviously, it had to have a great effect on you, right?
So not only do you have, you know, the knowledge you obtain, you know, a degree, but there's a certain social capital that you have, right? So upon my release, which was a few years after leaving Sing Sing, I came home to this alumni group of men and women who, like me, were in prison, who transitioned successfully, and who I could call on, right? As I was going through this new experience, this new phase. So I was in prison for nearly 15 years. I went in at the age of 20 and I came out around 34. So I was a very different person and just on so many different levels. And it was very, very key to my success to have this network of individuals who could say, I know where you're coming from. I know what you've done. And you can take this approach. You can take this path. I feel like one of the key things of having an education while you're on the inside is this sense of belonging, a part of the larger society, right? So while you're in for any length of period of time, there's a stigma that we all know of, you know, associated with being an incarcerated individual. But when you can add this title, right, for an individual who may begin a college program while they are on the inside or continue, it just connects you to society in a way that you weren't before, right? in some instances. And I feel like coming out, I felt very much prepared to enter the world. Of course, there are challenges, right? But I felt prepared for those challenges in so many ways. Like I came out with a 5-year plan, right, that I was able to develop, because you have this focus on critical thinking and analyzing things based on your educational background, right, depending on what type of program you're coming from. It just organizes your life in a specific way. So I came out with confidence that I would be fine. And I feel like that's the key component, is just having that confidence and belief, right? So it's not only the self-confidence in yourself, but the confidence that someone is going to give you an opportunity, right? You're going to figure it out. You're going to make a way for yourself. Like anything else, when you get into the flow of it, it becomes a part of you. And it's like that with learning, right? So I'm a lifelong learner. So I've come out and I've begun to educate myself again. You re-educate yourself, right? But it's because I developed those muscles while on the inside that I don't see myself ever hitting a wall and being so frustrated to where I say, well, let me try to do something that I would do before. It's like, no, you'll figure this out. You know, you've worked through tougher situations. So
it was a sense of empowerment is what you're saying.
Totally, totally. A sense of empowerment, a sense of belonging. Again, to the larger society, it's like, well, you know, this is, I can say I went to Mercy College like everyone else who went to Mercy College, because I did, right? My professors didn't pull any punches. So it's just a great experience. It's definitely empowering, to say the least.
And I guess you could say you went to Mercy College while you were in prison, which a lot of people have a hard time going to college being out, but you were able to do it through a whole nother group of obstacles.
It definitely comes with its challenges. I would say materials would be the first set of challenges, just having access to current and relevant information. The professors were very helpful with that. Of course, there are certain rules with information entering facilities. It's very slim, right? So as a college student, you incorporate your family maybe in there, right? So you're telling your family, well, listen, I'm in this program, I'm doing this thing, I'm making this change, but I need a little bit of research on this particular topic, right? But it's a beautiful, for me, it was a beautiful experience having now a graduation, and now my family can attend and see I'm becoming this person and I'm doing these things, and you know, my life has changed in these ways. Absolutely.
So Cheryl, so federal restrictions aren't the only thing dictating the operations of prisons. So what restrictions exist at a state level that individuals still face? And are they specific to Ohio that you could tell us about?
So do you mean to qualify to enroll
in these programs?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So the way that, so Pell for All will be coming in a year. Right now we're second chance Pell providers. But one of the things is that the DOCs of any given state have a set of criteria that they are like the gatekeeper. So they determine, is it in the best interest of the student? What's being offered? When? What are the outcomes? And then, of course, then you go for Department of Ed for the federal financial aid. So in the state of Ohio, you have to have, you know, high school diploma, GED, you have to have exemplary institutional behavior. One of the things is that you can only have one unexcused absence or tardy,
oh, wow.
Or you're out for a year. But you know, it's a paradigm shift. It really is. So they come early, they stay late. They are, honestly, I hear so many of our professors say they're the best students that they have. You know, I see people walk in the door and they walk out the door. They're talking, they're speaking much like Mr. Washington, and kudos, Mr. Washington. I love your story.
So higher education calls to mind collegiate programs. Will trade and skill programs see a benefit from this change as well? They would have to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in the state of Ohio, we are looking at their career tech programs as well as apprenticeship, and there are course equivalencies. So we're doing prior learning assessment. And then think of that. They walk out the door with this industry credential in a career technical field, but also post-secondary education. It's just a win-win.
So talk to us about the work that focuses on the reentry of individuals after they've spent time in the justice system. What's your sense of how education influences one's reentry? We heard a great story from Donna.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, we believe reentry starts literally the day you walk into the prison doors. But for us, we can control when they come through our doors. And so every single class, every interaction is talking about reentry, walking out the door, preparing for reentry. We bring people in that, have had similar experiences, such as Mr. Washington. We have a Returning Citizen Initiative that really focuses upon students prior to release and upon release and follows them, sort of like that community that Mr. Washington was speaking of. We have a comprehensive reentry plan. There is a class called Transitional Skills that we have that I think is honestly the most important class that we have. We can you know, provide all of this education, but if students don't know how to walk out the door and market themselves and basically invite employers to come with them on this journey and say, that might have been who I was, but it's not who I am, it's not who I'm going to be. You know, that five-year plan that Mr. Washington spoke of, so many of them have that, and I think that's just crucial.
So, Donald, tell me about your participation in helping others take this journey.
Right. So it's the sort of thing that you want for others. Right. So you find this program, you're in it, your life is changing, your mind is changing, your thinking is changing in so many ways. So it kind of it begins before you step out the door. Right. So you want to kind of encourage others to participate and that sort of thing. Now, at this point in my work with the Marshall Project, we kind of just really are focused on changing the narrative of criminal justice and kind of really being at the forefront of how stories are being told. So currently at the Marshall Project, I'm the co-creator and co-executive producer of a video production called Inside Story, which is created by formerly incarcerated individuals for currently incarcerated individuals to bring the Marshall Project stories to them in a way that they can consume and enjoy and find it informative.
So education has been available prior to the lift of this funding ban. If you could tell me, Cheryl, how exactly did they pursue their education without getting federal grants prior to?
So, and honestly, the state of Ohio is an amazing place to be offering programming. We would get state dollars, but it was very limited. And we also agreed to a lesser rate because our college just believes in this, you know, find a need and endeavor to meet it. And we really believe this meets the mission of what we're doing. We have a lot of internal support, and that's what we're finding in the state of Ohio. When I talk to people throughout the country, many of them have private grants. There may be some state dollars, but it's been very, very difficult to offer in this wide scale. So this is really going to just open up the door for so many different opportunities, 2+2s. We're starting the first 2 years with the community college and finishing with the university. We're piloting something like that in one of our northwestern prisons with Kent State University. So they start the first 2 years with us and then they finish with Kent State.
Are there nonprofits that get involved to try to help get folks started?
Yes, there are. There absolutely are. In the state of Ohio, that has not been the case. We haven't needed that, but that's not the avenue we've pursued. But that is definitely what has been going on in other states prior to the reinstitution of Pell.
So what additional resources does this increased funding allow second chance institutions to utilize?
So you mean like opportunities to pursue for mm-hmm. students? I think some of the things would be talking about research, talking about, I think it allows for a little bit of a greater funding model. You know, we are bringing in Chromebooks for all of our students. I think that's really important. We will never fully be all in the line. There's always going to be a face-to-face component. It's very, very important. I think I always say we have a great program, but it's the people who speak into the lives of the students that make the difference, you know. So that's some of the things, you know, research is going to be much greater. Listening to Mr. Washington talk to his family members, well, that's really great, but imagine just being able to do that research internally. And I think that's really important. Other things, I mean, you know, we will be expanding. I think, of course, our student body will probably increase. We'll also expand our Returning Citizen Initiative. And that's going to be one of the elements that you have to institute as a part of Pell for All, is that outcomes, looking at placement rates. Are people getting jobs in the areas that they are pursuing an education? I think that's really, really important. And we're just going to make sure that we can support that. And hopefully that will be the same for other colleges and universities.
Well, Donald Washington Jr. gave us a pretty good look at it can be done. And we want to thank you both for joining us. Donald Washington Jr. with the Marshall Project and Cheryl Taylor with St. Clair Community College as the Chief Officer of Prison Education. Thank you for joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher.